All right. Well, we are going to get back to our study of the 12 disciples. I'm actually shocked at the crowd here today. It's mainly not so much for me, but just this is a holiday weekend. So why are you people here? No, that's I won't say that. But anyway, it's a little too hot for most activities, in my opinion, anyhow. All right. Well, last week we covered two of these passages that I wanted to look into for Peter. And in terms of the notes that you have, I think I've pretty well covered the notes, the part one of Simon Peter. The last thing that I have on there is his involvement. I have inquisitiveness, initiative, and involvement. And involvement would definitely be the walking on the water. There are a few other places, like following Jesus into the house of the priest. He went to the tomb to see for himself. Of course, now when I look at that passage again, I'm wondering what the motivation was there, because the women told them. No, we're going to go see for ourselves. I'm not sure what's going on there, but we won't diverge into that. But I'm going to be in the second set of notes, which is part two, how does God develop a leader? And these passages are going to come from that. In fact, these next two, confession and denial, are going to fit together in the first two parts where I have revelation and regression. These notes were produced in a time when I used alliteration quite a bit. My students roll their eyes whenever I do that now, but I tell them if it works, I use it, and also it helps me remember things, so that's why I do that. But anyway, revelation and then regression, but really the revelation part is the confession. And I say it's a revelation because of Jesus' response to Peter in this event, that he is going to say that God revealed this to you. You did not come up with this on your own. One of the themes of today is really going to be that Peter, for all of the strengths that he was developing, and for his faithfulness to Jesus, and for all of the strengths that we do see, he still had an issue with recognizing his weaknesses and recognizing that if you could be an instrument for God, you can also be an instrument for Satan as well. And it's one of those things that we need to constantly remind ourselves of, and that is that we are, whatever abilities, whatever talents, whatever gifts God has given to us can be used for good or for evil. Even as followers of the Lord, it is possible to use God-given gifts for the wrong purposes. And that will actually drive people away from the Lord, maybe drive them towards the person rather than to the Lord. We should always have, not visibly, but some kind of an arrow that's always pointing to him in our lives, so that anything that we're doing should always be directing people to him rather than to ourselves. And I'm not saying that Peter is wanting the spotlight. Actually, that's going to fit a little more with John, James and John. But with Peter, the problem is that he just did not see his own weaknesses and the potential that was there for Satan to use him. And that's a lesson for all of us as well. Now, what I've done in this particular set of notes on this page, I have lessons everywhere. So there will be a lesson for each one of these parts. And then at the end, there's another interesting set of lessons when you compare with the New Testament book, 1 Peter. But for now, let's take a look at Matthew 16. And in fact, we're going to be in that text for both of these, the confession. Well, actually, not for the confession and denial. It will be the confession, and it's really two parts, the regression being used for Satan. But I will tell you that that's going to lead to the denial, ultimately. So let's take a look at Matthew 16, and Let me see exactly what part of Matthew 16 I want to start in. 15 is what I have marked, but let's just go back to verse 13, okay, for this text. So Matthew 16, 13. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Interesting, he doesn't use Peter there. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you," now he uses Peter, "you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Now, there's an awful lot in here. And if I were Roman Catholic, I would interpret verse 19 differently than a Protestant. But that's we will mainly be looking at Peter. Caesarea Philippi is where this takes place. And I think I've mentioned it in here before, but in the times that I've been over to Israel, that's one of the spots to visit. It's in the north of Galilee area. And it is a place that in the first century was known for one very specific thing. It was a temple that was put together by the Greek culture, and the Romans accepted it as well, and that is it was a temple to the god Pan. You know, the one with the flute, the god Pan. And so it was known as Panius, you know, god Pan. And they have excavated sufficiently enough to know what the temple would have looked like. It actually jutted out from a rock. And so the temple, they have a picture of the depiction of what it would have looked like, but it was a temple that stuck out from the rock, and this is a big rock face. For those of you who've been to Colorado and places like that, when you say rock, when I think rock here in Texas and where I live, I might think of something that's stuck in my lawn, you know, that I'm trying to get out of the lawn. But rock can also mean a giant rock face, as in a cliff. And so this is the kind of rock that they're going to be talking about here. The Hebrew language actually has many words for rock and stone, more than our language will allow for. So it's very difficult sometimes in translating the Old Testament when you have all these different words. We have pebble, stone, rock, but sometimes a rock is different. Sometimes they're big, sometimes they're small. Well, this is a giant rock face, and out of that rock was a temple, and there was a hole in this one specific spot of the temple where the sacrifices would have been made. We have some of the early historians like Josephus who talk about this place as well, so we have some details. But right under where that temple jutted out, there is a giant cave, big open area. Not a small one, but just a big open, looks like a mouth, which is significant because the ancients, and we have this in some of the Greek and Roman writings, called it the gate of hell because it was the entryway into Hades. And so that is the gate of hell. Now, I had no idea this is how I would interpret this passage had I not known that was going on. Because I always thought, well, the gates of hell will not prevail. He's just talking generally, metaphorically, but they're actually standing at the place where the gate of hell is, according to the people who are sacrificing. Probably the sacrifices were going on almost continuously, so you would hear especially goats and sheep and their cries as they were being sacrificed, and then the blood would be drained into that cave. And the way that it worked is that if your prayers were answered, and this never made much sense to me. It seems like it would be the opposite. But anyway, if your prayers were answered, you could go down to a little stream that was coming out of the earth. It was a spring that was coming out of the earth near where that hole was. And if that spring had blood in it, your prayers were answered. I think that was it. Whereas you'd think that it would be the opposite, where they would take the blood. But anyway, I think that's how that worked. That they would look there to see if the blood was there, then my prayers have been answered. And of course, you've got a bunch of priests there who also have control over the area. So I'm sure they're dripping blood in there every so often, or doing something to let people know so they could keep coming back and paying to have the sacrifices. So it was quite the business. But the issue is that you'd pray to the god Pan, you'd have the sacrifice, it would go into the gate of hell, and then the gods themselves would somehow, you know, indicate whether you were, you know, your prayer was answered. This is very much a pagan site. And Jesus has his disciples at this pagan site. It was very much controlled by those who were doing these sacrifices. And so it's interesting that at this point, he brings up this question, you know, who do you say the Son of Man is? Who do other people say first? And then who do you say? Whom are you saying is the Son of Man? Son of Man is interesting because that's a terminology that you'll find all through the Gospel of Luke, but not as often in Matthew. But it does seem like it's a term that Jesus liked to use for himself quite often. I know we think Son of God, but what's critical about Son of Man, his humanity is every bit of, as much a part of our redemptive plan as his deity. And it's very important that he is the new Adam, and that he is the one that fulfills that. But when they mention John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, one of the prophets, Peter is the one. It says, Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And so that confession is powerful. It's not necessarily indicating deity at this point, because Son of God is a title that even David and others would have had, meaning a representative of God. But Christ is the word that would be used for Messiah. So he is saying without any hesitation, you are the Messiah. Whatever other people are saying about you, this is who you are. And blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah. Now that's not obviously the Jonah of the Old Testament. This would be his father's name. But Simon, it's interesting that he doesn't say Simon Peter here, or just Peter, because I've told you that there's some movement that's taking place between his name, Simon, and then the Simon Peter with the two attached, and then just Peter. And so it's interesting. You'd think that it would be Peter, but why is he saying Simon? My thought is this, that Peter is not the one that is the source of this truth. This truth has come to him. He is just a conduit. He is nothing more than the Simon who was doing the fishing when Jesus saw him and called him. So he is that Simon. I honestly think that this little interchange here is the one that clues us in that Peter means that he is getting his strength from God completely, but he knows it. He's fully aware of it. Simon is, God is using him, but is he aware of that or not? I know that's reading a lot into just the name change, but it seems that it's significant all the way through the Gospels. And then, of course, Jesus' words, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I know we see that in such positive terms, and it is. You know, God has revealed this to you. Oh, I must be special because God revealed it to you. No, the issue is this. You didn't come up with that. That is God at work. Be aware of the difference. Know that when there are certain good things that are coming from our mouths, from our lives, from our behavior, that it is God at work, the Spirit's work. It is so easy for us. Every one of us has the tendency towards pride and arrogance in things that we do. And this is going to be the contrast, because this confession, we don't even have to change passages. The change is going to take place in this same passage. And I always point that out to people that, you know, this isn't a time thing. This isn't, well, today I'm being used by the Lord and I know that and everything's wonderful. Tomorrow I might be used for Satan. No, this is momentary. They're in the same location, same event, same time when that switch is going to take place. Now, what about some of these other things? Well, as I said, verse 18, you are Peter. That means rock. And on this rock, which he's using the word in Greek, Petra, not Petros, and that word would be used to describe this giant structure that they're next to. Upon this rock. Now, anyone who would be listening at this point probably would be looking at all the pagan sacrifice and all the stuff that's going on in this rock, although you would know this much: the pagans didn't build the rock, God did. So the rock is here. And if he says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, means that that is the offensive, not the defensive. When I was younger, I think I read it as defensive, you know, the gate that somehow Satan will attack, but he can't get through. No, this is the opposite. The gates of hell is going towards hell. We're the ones going through the gates. It's very much an offensive terminology, which means that this structure, this belief, all this paganism will not prevail against the church that's being built. And I'll tell you what's powerful is once you're at the site or you know the history and you're standing there and you're looking at the picture of what things would have looked like and all of the sacrifices taking place even while they're standing there, and the ones who know how to do it will say, and notice, it's not here anymore, but the church is. That's the powerful message at that moment. Now, even if I didn't know that background, I still should be able to catch that the church will prevail against all of the forces of hell. And we are the ones on the offensive, not on the defensive. We feel like we're on the defensive all the time because of all the attacks. But realize this is also going to take place in the first century when Rome is going to persecute Christians. And yet this truth still remains. Rome cannot defeat Christians, but not only that, Christianity will plow through Rome itself. I don't agree with Edward Gibbon on some things, the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, because he didn't like Christians all that much. But he blamed the fall of Rome on Christians. And immediately Christians are like, oh, you know, we didn't do that. It's like, no, take credit for that. It was Christianity that destroyed slavery in their system. It was Christianity that tore apart all of the paganism, that people could not find the truth in paganism and they turned to Christianity because that's where the truth was. Christianity was on the offensive, even during the persecutions. Because what happens with martyrs, you know this. You know, if you have a martyr, that actually makes it more powerful than if it's just somebody that, falls off the scene somehow. It actually made Christianity stronger. You'd have to continue on with the rest of the history of Christianity in the New Testament, which is the book of Acts. Luke did that, and he talks about those things. So I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Everybody always points out, oh, that makes Peter the first pope. But that is not what that's talking about. In fact, I think Peter is functioning as a representation there, that this is the church that we're talking about. And so it's not that he's the leader of the church. No one would have thought that of him at this point anyway. It is that he's a representation. For all those who proclaim that Jesus is the Christ, the keys of heaven itself will be given to you. And the apostles themselves would demonstrate this, not just Peter. I'm getting ready to teach another class, not here, but somewhere else. And we're getting into the Peter's miracle in Acts chapter 9. It's right after the Paul events, you know, where he turns and changes. And there's a woman named Tabitha, and he raises her from the dead. Through God's power, of course. But I mean, that's the key. That's the keys of death there. And God is giving that to his followers. So then we have the strange thing, charging the disciples, telling the disciples, don't tell anyone that I'm the Christ. That is so strange. We always call that the messianic secret. but there are times when Jesus is perfectly fine with someone going and telling others. In fact, I'll tell you where it usually happens is when you're not in the Jewish context. You remember the demoniac who was in the chains and, you know, kind of a crazy man, and the disciples wanted to get in the boat and get away from there. And anyhow, Jesus heals him, and then he goes and tells the village, and then they become, you know, they are drawn to Christ. And so there's no secret there. But in the Jewish context, it seems like, let's keep this secret. Don't go around saying I'm the Christ in these contexts. And my thought on that is primarily, and I'm not the only one who thinks this, but my thought on that is it's not his time to be put to death quite yet. And the moment that comes out, that's going to be a problem. As it is, the Jewish authorities are trying to pin him on that, and to say, you are saying you are God, you are saying you are the Christ, and those are two different things, but they're trying to find a way to get him on a blasphemy charge, and they can't do that. Not until they get to the end, and even at the end, they don't really crucify him on the blasphemy charge. The crucifixion is on the peace of Rome being affected by this man, which is the only way the Romans would pay any attention to it anyway. So let's jump down then to verse 21. We're right on the cusp of this. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. That's the appropriate time. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Now, what is profound about this text is that it's coming right on the heels of the other one. I mean, we are talking about, well, Matthew's doing this intentionally, I believe, putting the two together. And it's not to diminish anything about Peter, but it is really to demonstrate that an instrument for God can be an instrument for Satan. And why is that? Because he has set his mind on he has not set his mind on the things of God. It is God's purpose that Jesus be crucified. It is God's purpose that he becomes the suffering servant, as prophesied in the Old Testament. That's God's purpose. You are a hindrance because now you are standing in the way. You have become an obstacle to that goal because of what you're doing. One of the few times Peter is silent after that moment. At least we don't have anything recorded. And then notice that the very next passage is, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me, which we've talked about already a couple weeks ago. So anyway, that's all in the confession part, but it is important in the notes. I call it regression. Let's jump ahead to the denial. We have a couple of passages that we can examine, but I want to focus my attention on the one that no one usually pays as much attention to. Most of the time when people are looking at the denial, they look at Matthew, and it's primarily because in Matthew we have a lot of predictions of the denial. If you go all the way back to Matthew 10 and you go through other passages, there's this constant, you know, Peter, you're going to deny me, you know. So there's a constant reminder to him. In Luke, we don't have as much of that, so people tend to push aside the Luke passage a little more often. But I want to look at Luke 22 because I want you to see something that demonstrates to me one of the reasons why I'm picking the passage, and that is that I believe this is as close to Peter's perspective on the whole thing as any other passage. There's also a John 13 passage as well. But Luke 22, let me make sure I get the right verse here, 54. Yeah, this is not in the notes, by the way, so you might want to mark that in the notes. But 22:54, it's the parallel for Matthew, but it's not exactly the same. It is different. And there's one key little part different that we'll look at when we get to the end of the passage. So, verse 54, then they seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house, referring to Jesus. And Peter was following at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down among them. Then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, said, "This man also was with him." Now, you could dramatize the event to some degree, but here's Peter just, you know, out here trying to be incognito as much as possible. And here's this servant girl that just keeps, you know, looking at him and which would be annoying in itself, but then saying, "Oh, yeah, you were with him." But he denied it, saying, "Woman, I do not know him." And I'm saying it with the tone that I think he would have used. And a little later, someone else saw him and said, "You also are one of them." But Peter said, "Man, I am not." And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, "Certainly this man also was with him, for he too is a Galilean." But Peter said, "Man, I do not know what you are talking about." And immediately while he was speaking, the rooster crowed. Now, here's the part. Not in any of the other gospel accounts. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. The only one who would have known that would have been Peter himself. I think Luke is using Peter as a resource here. But since we're talking about Peter, I want us to catch that. It's not that Matthew's inaccurate. In fact, Matthew has all of the things that are here. But the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. That moment at the beginning of 61, I cannot put into words. I cannot imagine. After the third time, and then the Lord actually, Jesus, just looks at him. No words, probably at a distance. He's being led to his own suffering. But here is Peter, the one who believed that he would not deny the Lord, that he would not ever turn against him. And here he is. And all Jesus needs to do is look at him. And that's all it takes. Again, I don't have words for that. for that moment when Peter realizes something that we saw back here in the confession. You can be an instrument of God, you can be an instrument for Satan, but here you are denying the very Lord that you have followed all these years and that you have committed yourself to. And that has happened. This is going to stick with him. How do I know that? Because when we get to the restoration passage, that's the crucial thing. I don't think you can understand John 21. We can turn there now, by the way, but I don't think you can understand John 21 without knowing the betrayal and the three times. And I find it fascinating, too, that the three times comes back in John 21. I really think the parallel, everyone focuses on the difference in the term love here, which I do think has some significance, but really it's the three times. Why three times? All right, so I'll start at the beginning of the chapter. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. And then it mentions Simon, Peter, Thomas, called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." And they said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Now, we've already looked at that passage, too, in the call of Peter. All night, caught nothing. Now, I'm sure there were many moments where that probably took place. But the parallelism is significant because when did Jesus call him? On the night that he didn't catch any fish. That was the call itself. And so this is one of the most beautiful ways for John to wrap up his gospel. And I know we had a study of the gospel of John here, and so we've heard this passage. But I want you to think of it in the context, the larger context of the gospels, and especially with Peter here. The focus is going to be on Peter. What's also fascinating to me is I don't want to go so far as say conflict, but at least competitiveness between John and Peter. It's obvious throughout the Gospel of John. We don't see it in the other Gospels quite as much, but it seems that John and Peter, there's a bit of a tension. John's most likely younger. John and Andrew seem to hang out with each other more often. So probably younger, but John's patience with Peter, there's not much of it as he goes through in his gospel. Again, we would have to go through the whole gospel to try to see how it's different from the other gospel accounts. But anyhow, what's so beautiful about this to me is this is John's way of himself forgiving Peter and also of highlighting Peter in a way that wouldn't have been in the other Gospels. They knew each other. They knew each other well enough. So just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Now, what does that remind you of? I want you to notice he's weaving a lot of accounts in at the same time, and if John is writing after the other Gospels, these other accounts are already there. And if they weren't already there in written form, they certainly were there in their oral tradition. The disciples didn't know it was Jesus, even though he's standing on the shore. When did they not know it was Jesus? When he showed up in the walking on the water. We have gone through these two right here. The walking on the water, they did not recognize him. And Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat and you will find some." Is such a repeat of what we had. But remember, before it was not all the rest of the disciples. It was Peter. He said to them, So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. It's almost as if he has brought the two passages together, but I do believe this is historical, and this is the event repeated. It actually has taken place again. And the disciple whom Jesus loved therefore said to Peter, this is one of my favorite moments, it is the Lord. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and he threw himself into the sea. That's one of my favorite moments in all the Gospels. He jumped into the sea. I think it was Ritterboss. I've told you he's my favorite John commentator. And he makes some comment about when Peter finally dried himself off or something. It was like he came out of the water, then he composed himself. But at this point, it's that impulsiveness. He just jumps in the water. I can only imagine what the rest of the disciples are thinking. Of course, they were with Peter all those times, so they know he's impulsive. But, you know, it's the Lord, and then, you know. But we see the result of the denial, right? Because the last time that there was any direct contact was that. And Jesus looking at him. That's why I wanted that Luke passage. So now you can imagine what's going through Peter's mind. Oh, no. Remember the last time this occurred, it was he was overwhelmed by the very holiness of God in the presence of all the fish and the miracle that took place. Well, now he's overwhelmed with the sense of guilt, the sense of the resurrected Christ, you know, who's right there. I can't even imagine. That's why he did have time enough to put his outer cloak on, but still, he jumps in the water. And let's see here. Yeah, threw himself into the sea. Verse 8, the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. And Jesus said, bring some of the fish that you have just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. John counted them apparently. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, oh, I remember a powerful sermon. Come and have breakfast. That was the name of the sermon. It's the restoration moment. It's the come and eat. Join me for food. Join me for breakfast. Remember, the last moment of Jesus looking at him after he denied, and now come and have breakfast with me. The resurrected Christ. I get emotional because the sermon was so powerful. On Jesus says, come and have breakfast. You've fallen. You've been distant from me. You don't have the fellowship with me that you used to have. You have drifted away. Now I'm telling you, come and have breakfast. Now none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. So there's no conversation. There's no theological discussion. You know, how can you be like this? How do you eat? You're in the resurrected body. There's nothing like that. I like to point that out to a lot of theologians, too, because it's like there are moments when we don't need all of the discussion and trying to figure it all out. They knew it was the Lord, and they were with him. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. Oh, by the way, we've got another connection, right? The bread, the fish, the miracle. Everything in this passage is just reminding these disciples of the time that they spent with Jesus. The miracles that they saw, the moments when he demonstrated who he really was. And now it's starting to connect, although it doesn't, I don't know if it fully connects. We don't have that. They just knew it was him. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Oh, there's another three. Lots of threes going to come in here. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he's referring to those who are around, not the fish, okay? It's do you love me more than these? And he said to them, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, feed my lambs. And he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said it a third time. Now, we always read that as, well, he's asked you if you love him. You keep saying you do. You must not, or else he wouldn't keep asking. But notice it's the third time that gets him. Three times, just like the denial. That's the parallel. It's not the difference in the words as much, although I'll admit, you know, the first two times he uses the word agapao, which is the word for love, sorry to all those of you listening. It can refer to sacrificial love. But I can tell you this, in doing word studies on both these terms, there's a lot of overlap. There are times when the word agapao or agape, as you've heard it, doesn't always have to be sacrificial. But he does use that term twice, and then he goes to phileo, which is another word for a friendship kind of love. And then that's when the confirmation takes place, it seems. So I do know there's something going on there. My problem is I'm not exactly sure all that's going on between the use of those two terms. I don't want to go so far as to say that he's asking him if you sacrificially love me, because he says I phileo you, which is a different word, but I don't want to make quite as much out of that distinction. Everybody zeroes in on that. The thing that I want to do is to notice the three times. And notice how Peter responds to it. Where were we? What verse was that? On the 3:17. Okay, yes. And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Now, Peter's a fisherman, not a farmer. But there has already been the connection. Actually, I could take you back in the Old Testament to show that connection with David and with God being called the shepherd. And Jesus later referring to himself as the good shepherd. He is giving Peter the responsibility to be the one who is actually going to feed his flock, Jesus' flock. You're going to be overseeing that flock. And yes, the term is a word that we later use for pastor, but Peter is being given a responsibility over what Jesus himself has dominion over. There's a creation thing connecting it to, you know, image bearers of God having dominion over the animals. It's not sheep, of course, that we're talking about. We're going to be talking about people, just as when it wasn't just fish, but it's you're going to be fishers of men. The point is that Peter is now being told, you're not just restored to me. You were here, maybe you were here, but I'm restoring you here. That's how he works. And yet the sin, and yet the rejection. All of the things that would put Peter on the blacklist, if you will, with God and with Jesus. Instead, come and have breakfast. Feed my sheep. You're in that position. You know, as I said, it's amazing to me that it's John that's giving us this detail, because none of the others do. This is a passage that's unique to John. So truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. Now, of course, we could read that and say, what are you talking about? I mean, everyone, when they get old, that's how things work. But notice that John adds the little comment. This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. Now, I know that in John's mind, he's got to be thinking of his own situation where the mother of James and John came and, you know, sit on my right and my left. And we're going to get to that. We haven't done that yet. But, you know, the cup that they are going to drink is also a cup of suffering and death. But here it's focused on Peter. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. So it's the call all over again. It's so beautiful because it pulls everything together. Everything that we've already looked at is pulled together in this passage. And all of the pictures of what Peter had experienced with Jesus, the moment of the call, the moment of the of even the walking on the waters kind of hinted at. You've got the follow me, deny yourself and follow me. Peter learned his lesson. I am convinced of that. I'm not going to go on to the rest of that passage because that gets us into John, and we'll talk about him a little later. Going back to my notes, though, the recommission, I call it, but it's essentially Jesus is seeking Peter again. I say, once set apart by God, he will never abandon you. We can turn our backs on him many, many times, and our sin will lead us there. But he will bring us back. If we are one of his, he goes after lost sheep. He does this all the time. And he's always going after those who feel apathetic, who don't have the kind of desire that they once had. Maybe their first love has died out. It's so easy for that to happen. But Jesus, here with Peter, it shows that he will bring him back and he will restore him, but not just restore him in his initial position. He puts him higher. He puts him in an even stronger position. I don't know how to describe God's grace in any other way than to show that. Now, Peter learning the lesson, this is for your homework because I'm not going to go through all of these, but it's in the notes. Specific lessons. I think I saw this in a commentary once, but anyhow, I don't think it was original to me, but I found it fascinating. These are all different concepts, topics that come up throughout the Gospels and are directly connected to Peter. Submission, restraint, love, sacrifice, humility, and even the threat of Satan. And what's interesting is in 1 Peter, and it happens to be in, well, I've put it in the 1 Peter order. That's why it's all there that way. But in Peter's first letter, all of those points are emphasized in those passages. Read the gospel passage. You'll see Peter in the interaction or something Jesus was teaching the disciples in general or Peter specifically, and he learned that lesson. And he puts them all in that letter. That's what's pretty powerful. Even the threat of Satan, who is always there in the background. So, and I wrote a little bit. Actually, this lesson I usually give when I talk about Jacob, but God does not, I shouldn't say cannot, does not use anyone until the lesson is learned. In other words, strength through weakness. That's the lesson that we all need to learn. If we do not come to God humbly, he'll take care of that for us. He knows how. But don't worry, even if he pushes us down, brings humility in our lives, he will restore us. He's doing it out of love. He's doing it because that is the way that we have to understand our relationship with him. Anytime that I think, I got this, I've told you this with my teaching experience, you know, if I came in here today and I just thought, I got this, I've taught this before, I know what I'm doing, so on, it would be a disaster. I did pray before because I know that no matter how much strength I think I have on my own, it's never my strength. It can't be. It will never work that way. And it's a lesson that we have to keep relearning throughout our lives. God's patience is amazing, that he will put up with us like that. All right, I'm a little later than I was, I think, last week. But go ahead if anyone has any comment, question.
Amen.